could come back into order so we can adjourn a little early. Okay. As I mentioned, the next item we'll take up is number 10. We're going to do this so that we can await some guests for item number 9. But number 10 is WDFW's Forest Management Strategy on Department Lands. This is a briefing. Clay Sprague, Lands Division Manager. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you want to... Oh, and Richard, I don't think I've met you before, but how do you pronounce your last name?
Tvetan.
Tvetan. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Commission and Director Anderson. As you indicated, my name is Clay Sprague. I'm the Lands Division Manager with Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Richard Tvetan here is a project manager for our Forest Management Strategy. And he'll be giving you an informational briefing on that plan in just a second. But before he does that, I'd like to provide you a little context for this effort, as well as some other planning efforts that are going on in the Wildlife Program and the Lands Division. We're the major effort that's going on is we're developing a new wildlife area planning process right now that we plan to begin using after the first of the year to develop new wildlife area plans. In fact, we plan to complete 4 new wildlife area plans by June of 2015 using this new process. And this process is emphasizing several areas, but particularly these three that you see on this slide: forest management, public outreach and participation, and wildlife-related public use and recreation. Now, these three focus areas have their own planning efforts going on in addition to the overall wildlife planning process. And just to show you how they all relate and timing-wise, the forest management strategy that Richard will talk about here in a minute is nearing completion right now, and we're here in front of you today for the informational briefing. But after going through a SEPA process, it will be to the director for his consideration for approval probably in December or maybe early January. In addition, the Lands Division is nearing completion of a Wildlife Area Advisory Committee guidance document. Wildlife Area Advisory Committees is what we used to call the Citizens Advisory Groups. We're changing the name on that. And this particular guidance document is really focused on providing helpful tools to the wildlife area managers for the management and use of the wildlife area advisory committees, particularly in the area of public outreach, but more importantly, in participation, because we'll be relying on them throughout this wildlife area planning process. We've also recently completed a meeting facilitation training of all the wildlife area managers in anticipation of this, and we're also planning additional training in public outreach techniques in December. So these will be techniques that will go beyond the Wildlife Area Advisory Committee in terms of getting public participation in the various planning efforts that we'll have going forward. And then finally, we're in the beginnings of developing a recreational management strategy as well. We're hoping to have a first draft of this plan in late winter, early spring. Plan to also bring that in front of you for an informational briefing around that time frame. But hopefully, after public review and comment, would have a final plan again to go to the director for his consideration for approval late summer. Now, all of these efforts, as indicated by this slide, as they are completed or are nearing completion, will be folded into this wildlife area planning process that you see on the green arrow at the bottom to be used on these development of these 4 new plans that we'll be working on to both test and improve these various elements. So that's kind of a very brief overview of all the planning efforts leading up to the development of this new wildlife area planning process. And I'd be glad to answer any questions before Richard talks about the forest management strategy.
Any questions? Director Anderson?
This is really an exciting process that Wildlife Program and Lands Division is embarking on, and I think it's going to kind of set a new base from which to manage our wildlife areas. We'll have input from the public as we go along and we establish these priorities, and so coming out the end of this, it's going to be, I think, a much more upgraded, thoughtful approach to how we're doing wildlife area management. And the forestry part that you're going to hear about in a minute is really a critical part of that. So I'm really excited about what all these folks are doing.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, the idea of putting together the wildlife areas forest management strategy is we have a lot of forests, and we've done a lot of good things to manage them, but we haven't had a comprehensive kind of umbrella-like structure that we can be consistent in making decisions on how we're going to manage our forests and how we're going to prioritize efforts. So just kind of as a preview, what I'm going to do is provide a brief description of our forests, what the management issues are associated with them, summarize our past and present management activities and levels, and then kind of talk about what this strategy includes, and talking about defining our desired future conditions and the approaches for managing towards those conditions. And of course, you can't manage your forest if you don't have a good inventory of them and understand what you have. And so here's just some basic information about the forests that are on Fish and Wildlife areas. We have about 200,000 acres of forest. That's about a fifth of the land that we manage. And there's 22 different ecological systems or types of forest on our property. And those can be lumped into three categories. Seven of those systems that make up three-quarters of all the forest in our portfolio are forests that require frequent fire. 10 of the systems, which amount to only 15% of our forests, they do not need or have frequent fires in them. And then there's five of the systems that are riparian, and they may or may not have fire, but they have a whole different set of rules on how they're regulated because of fish protections and things like that. And there are maps that show the distribution of these different forest types. It's put together by a kind of a consortium of agencies, primarily the Department of Interior, Forest Service, and BLM. And they show where the different forests are distributed across the country and across the nation. This graphic here is of the Soda Springs unit of the Klickitat Wildlife Area, just as an example. So if you look at that map, all the brown, those are our oak woodlands. We have more oak woodlands on the Klickitat than all the other wildlife areas combined. There's a little bit of orange in there. That's kind of the ponderosa pine savanna. That kind of olive green is the mixed dry forest. That's a combination of ponderosa pine and Douglas fir. And then as you get to the west in the Cascades by Mount Adams, there's kind of a mixed forest. It's kind of cooler and wetter higher up in the mountains. So, and we can look at that and we can overlay it with our property, and we pretty much know what forest types we have across all of our wildlife areas. And knowing what different types of forests we have can help us strategize of what we need to do to manage the different forests. And especially in eastern Washington, in those dry forests that historically evolved under frequent fire, we've had a huge change in those forests over the last century with fire suppression and timber management. Well, historically, a lot of those forests used to have a relatively small number of large trees that were widely spaced, and you had a very diverse, lush understory. And what we've done is cut out all the big trees over the last 100 years, or a lot of them, and then a tremendous number of small trees have grown up underneath. And we have a very different type of forest as habitat, but also very different when it comes to how fire behaves when they catch on fire. So what's happened over the last century is the ecological integrity of these forests have gone down a lot, which has been really harmful for a lot of priority species that are dependent on those historic conditions. And then the risks have gone way up, and that's both wildfires and insect outbreaks. So that's why we need to actively manage them, and if we don't actively manage them, we'll end up doing a lot of salvage work to try to restore some of the conditions. So one of the things is all the forests have been mapped based on their vegetation condition class. And what this is they've been mapped and lumped into three different categories. And the dark green is an area where it is within the range of historic conditions. So it has basically the same structure and the same type of trees that it did, say, 100, 1,000 years ago. The areas in yellow on that map are areas that have diverged from that historic condition. They're different, but not drastically different. And the areas that are red have diverged dramatically from the historic condition. And this picture right here is of the Sherman Creek Wildlife Area up by Kettle Falls. And if you look at that map, you can see that almost all of the forests have diverged quite a bit from the historic condition. And we've been doing commercial thinning up there for the last 5 years, restoring the structure and species composition of the forests on that wildlife area. This map is a pretty colorful one, and what it depicts is the historic fire frequency on that Soda Springs unit of the Klickitat Wildlife Area. And I've coded the map so the bright colors, the hot colors, represent frequent fire. And the red means that area, those areas burn maybe every 5 or 10 years. And the orange is every 15 to 20 years. And then when you get to the cooler colors, like green, it might be every 75 years. And you get to blue, it might be every, you know, once every 200 or 500 years. So what really jumps out for eastern Washington is those forests used to burn quite frequently. And if they don't get that fire, they start to drift away from the historic condition. You get far more trees than you used to have, far more fuel than you used to have. And one of the consequences of that is the trees, they overpopulate. There's not enough water to support them all, and they get stressed every summer when there's a drought conditions. And because of that, there have been widespread insect outbreaks, not just in Washington, but throughout the West. And this map right here shows areas where the Department of Natural Resources has modeled the forest and predicted the areas of where insect mortality is going to have a significant impact on the trees. So in this map, once again, it's the Soda Springs unit. The orange, or the brownish orange, represents areas where bark beetles are predicted to do a significant amount of damage to the forest. And the red represents areas where they expect at least 20% of all the trees will be dead by 2021. So as you can see, it's a widespread problem. It's not limited to our property. And because it's such a big widespread problem, DNR has issued forest health hazard warnings. And they've issued that for the area down by Goldendale in Klickitat County, but they've also issued that warning up in north central Washington throughout the Okanagan. And basically what DNR is saying is you should go in and thin those forests and restore the health of the forest before the bugs kill the trees. And with the warning, you're not required to thin them, but the next step is a forest health hazard forget the term, but basically they insist that you do it. And we're not to that level yet. But they do have the hazard warning, and that affects quite a few of our wildlife areas. The other thing we need to be concerned about, this is a closer zoomed-in image of the Soda Springs unit of the Klickitat Wildlife Area, and that is if we don't manage the forests to address the fuels and the overstocking of trees, the fire hazard gets to the point where it's if a big fire starts, you know, it's really hard to handle it. And this picture here of the Soda Springs unit, you see a bunch of little orange polygons and circles on the east edge there? That's the Glenwood Highway. And there's, I counted 145 structures, homes, shops, barns, within a quarter mile of the wildlife area. And some of them are within inholdings in the wildlife area. So we have a significant risk to life and property if wildfire starts on the Klickitat wildlife area. And unfortunately, the prevailing winds head directly towards all those homes and structures. So that's one of the factors we need to take into account when it comes to managing our forest. It's not just wildlife. It's other things we need to take care of, too. So the way we manage our forest can go a long ways to addressing the risks associated with fire. The picture on the right is a prescribed fire on the Sinlahiquin Wildlife Area. That forest was thinned last year, and that prescribed fire was lit in May of this year. And as you can see, it just kind of creeps along the ground, cleans up the fuel, and helps kind of restore that open, grassy savanna structure. Opposed to the Kalakum Tarps fire, where all you can do is stand back at a safe distance and watch it burn. And that Kalakum Tarps fire was almost exclusively on our land. And that's about a $12 million effort to fight that fire. And unfortunately, it didn't just kill the little trees, but it killed a lot of the old legacy trees that were hidden within the forest of all the younger trees. So kind of a summary of our past and present management. We have pretty good records since 2000. Going back before that, it's not as detailed because the DNR didn't have the permitting process where you keep detailed records. But in the last 12 years, we've been treating on average about 950 acres of our forests. And some of that is commercial thinning, oftentimes where there's insect outbreaks, or salvage logging after fires. So I'd say about two-thirds of it's proactive and about a third of it is reactive. A lot of that salvage was after the school fire down on the Wooten Wildlife Area. If you go back, we have records of forest management activities back to 1962. And from 1962 to 1999, we had projects where we'd harvest and manage trees on about 140 acres per year, which is, you know, getting down to like 0.1% of the forest that we manage. And if we're going to manage our forest to compensate for fire, with all the fire suppression that's across this state, we really should be managing our forest at a much higher level if we're going to try to maintain those historic conditions that happen to be good for wildlife, but also a lot safer for when it comes to wildfires. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a series of pictures kind of illustrating the desired future condition of our forests, which reflect kind of the historic structure of forests that are more sustainable than what we've got now. So this is a couple pictures from the Methow Wildlife Area. Much of the Methow forest looked like the picture on the left, where the forests have filled in with sometimes 600 little trees per acre. The picture on the right is a remnant fragment of what most of the forest used to look like. That kind of opening with the big trees on the forests in the ponderosa pine forests of eastern Washington, historically, 70% of them look like the foreground of that picture. And nowadays, only about 3% look like that. So that's a pretty dramatic change in the forest. Now, we have the other end of the spectrum. We have the forests that historically hardly ever burned. Forest in western Washington, out on the coast and up in the mountains. And a lot of that was, you know, old growth, cedar and hemlock and fir and spruce. And what's happened with those forests is a lot of the land that we've acquired in Western Washington, we bought after the previous owner had logged it. So that picture on the left is land that we acquired down by Mount St. Helens in 2011. And we've got more than 1,000 acres of Douglas fir plantation where the trees were planted very tight, very close together. And, of course, they sprayed and killed every other type of tree that was on that land. So we have this monoculture of uniform-sized trees with no diversity. And that is an area where, you know, the elk need to winter and there's very limited food. And so what we could do is go in there maybe one time, thin it out, and kind of speed up succession to where we can get more like that picture on the right. It'll eventually get there on its own. We could just stand back and not do anything, and it'll get there. But we could go in and kind of speed that up and make it better habitat sooner. I bring up oak woodlands because they're considered a priority habitat. And also, oak woodlands contain our habitat for a lot of priority species. We've got threatened and endangered species, or you know, possible future listed ones that live in this pretty rare type of structure. And what's happened with that, with oak woodlands, is they need fire, frequent fire, if they're going to persist in areas where conifers can also survive. Because without fire, conifers grow a lot faster. They grow up over the top of them, they shade them out, and they die. So the picture here is from Oak Creek, and on the left you can see where there's one oak tree standing, and a couple of them have fallen over, and they're shaded out by the conifers. And to really have a nice oak woodland, you need to keep those things knocked back. And the thing about the oak woodlands, it's not just the trees. It's everything that grows on the ground underneath them disappears as well. And this, by the way, is a very small fraction of our forests. We have maybe 10,000 acres total and only a couple hundred acres in Western Washington. The other forest that's of a concern is aspen woodlands, which are also considered a priority habitat. And it turns out that in the western United States, more than 75% of all aspen stands have basically fizzled out. They're not there anymore. And the reason for that is they're very dependent on frequent disturbances, usually fire, but other things like landslides and floods and beavers can maintain them. And the picture on the left is from the Sinlahican, and this is pretty common on a lot of our eastern Washington wildlife areas, where the last aspen tree is dying in the shade of the conifers. Now, the picture on the left is a look at a nice, healthy aspen stand, and that was on the Wells Wildlife Area. And you can see in the background a lot of dead little ponderosa pine, and in the foreground they're kind of scorched. This is where the Central Ferry Canyon fire burned last summer, and it kind of knocked back the conifers to keep that aspen stand from getting overwhelmed by the conifers. Once again, this is a very small fraction of our forests. We only have maybe 300 or 400 acres of this type of forest left. And they're getting to the point where they're hard to even pick up because they're so overshaded and hiding in the conifer stands. So we have been doing good management projects to kind of do this, and I'll just show you some examples. Here's a before and after picture of a project on the Methow Wildlife Area, where it's just totally overwhelmed with little ponderosa pine, and what they've done is they've culled out the little ones so that the big ones will survive if there's a fire. And that's also good for the species that are dependent on open forests, kind of like the flammulated owls and those kind of critters. Here's a picture of a before and after at the Sinlahican Wildlife Area. On the left, there's about 600 trees per acre. but hiding within those 600 trees per acre are maybe 10 to 15 larger trees. And so what they've done at the Sinlahican is they've gone in, thinned out those smaller trees, and usually it's fir trees that are crowding out ponderosa pine, and then they'll haul out those small trees, and then they'll come in and burn the slash to try to restore the fuel levels and the ground level vegetation. So, you know, why do we need a statewide strategy? Well, we don't have enough resources to deal with it all right away. And some areas are at more, they have a more pressing need, that if we don't deal with it right away, we may lose them before we get it, before we get in to address the problem. And the other thing is it can help us secure funding, because we can kind of help define the issues and the level of effort that's needed. And we can better follow our agency mission and policy. We're supposed to preserve and protect and perpetuate forest, you know, wildlife in our forests or wildlife habitat. But also to provide sustainable fish and wildlife recreational and commercial opportunities. You know, some of our wildlife areas, we basically have to shut people out in the summer because of the DNR fire hazard warnings. People aren't allowed in the woods. Or the fires are so severe that, you know, people can't, you know, the wildlife are pushed out for a while. And finally, part of our mandate is we can allow wildlife, you know, compatible commercial activities. And, you know, restoration projects can be good for the economy and the habitat at the same time. So kind of the outline of the strategy is the first one of all is to kind of define our values and priorities, provide an inventory of our forests so people can understand the types of forests we have and the conditions of those forests, lay out the vision, which I kind of helped illustrate with some of those images. And one of the things is the vision isn't just ecological. It needs to include the social and economic components as well. And that's pretty clear when you saw that picture of all those houses right along the edge of the wildlife area. And then kind of lay out the strategy for how we're going to manage our forests, and I'll get to that in a minute. And then the projects and procedures and methods for rolling out projects. And this isn't something that I was able to do on my own. We had a lot of collaboration within the department and with others outside of the department. We pulled in people not just from the Lands Division, but from science and diversity within the wildlife program and people from Habitat program. We had kind of a working group with people from headquarters and the regions. And then we partnered with some external experts. We included the DNR's Natural Heritage Program. They're the ones that mapped out these ecological systems and defined the risks and threats to them and some of the recommendations for maintaining or restoring them. Also, DNR's forest health and inventory staff, they're the ones that came up with those health hazard warnings, and they're the ones who also have recommendations of how to bring them back so that those hazards are reduced. Did a lot of work talking to and getting information from the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. Most of our land from about Oak Creek up to the Canadian border is right. Most of our forests are right next to theirs, and sometimes we're even checkerboarded with their land. So they've done a lot of kind of research and strategy development for managing forests that's so close to ours that it'd be a shame not to take advantage of it. Capitalizing on land fire information. Those maps that I showed you were largely based on the land fire stuff. And the Nature Conservancy. They have collaborated with our managers to develop forest restoration projects on Oak Creek Wildlife Area, the Sinlahican Wildlife Area, and the Methow. And some of those pictures I showed you, the before and after, were from some of those projects. So basically, the desired future conditions is we'd like our forests to reflect more the historic range of variability in forests. And the reason for that is they would have a higher levels of ecological integrity. Kind of the definition of ecological integrity is based on those historic range of conditions. It would be good for priority species that evolved in tandem with those conditions, and it would make our forests more resilient and more adaptable. That would be to wildfire, insects, and climate change. And the reason I say climate change is kind of the predicted issues related to climate change for forests is that they would be more vulnerable to drought and insects and fire, and the historic condition is more adapted to drought and insects and fire. And when you have 600 little trees per acre, every year is a drought, whether there's a drought or not. So it's like in a lot of these forests, they've already experiencing the equivalent of climate change. So here's kind of the general approaches that are in the strategy. If a forest has high integrity, or it's on a natural good trajectory to get there all on its own, we don't need to do anything. All we have to do is protect the trees and let them grow. If a natural process, for example, fire, has been altered or eliminated, then we need active management to somehow compensate for that change. And that would be periodic thinning, and prescribed fire could help compensate for that alteration. And kind of the third scenario is we've acquired plantations that lack structure and they're on a poor trajectory. So let's say we got an area in eastern Washington that historically was a ponderosa pine forest. Somebody converted it to a Douglas fir plantation. The bark beetles and the spruce budworm are all in it. I mean, the thing may be to go in and thin that out and replant it with, so you get the proper ratio of species in there. Or in western Washington, you just want to speed it up because you don't want little trees for 200 years. You want to get big trees faster. And then kind of the fourth approach is if a big disturbance comes in and you have a lot of dead and dying trees and they present a safety hazard or environmental hazard, you go in and you salvage those trees, and when you do it in such a way that you're actually restoring the conditions as well. Because a fire might not kill all the trees. And if you strategically take out a lot of the dead ones and some of the live ones, you can get that historic structure back. So one of the things that I did in this strategy document was define suitable management areas. We have 200,000 acres, and it is not necessary nor appropriate that we actively manage all those acres of forest. So here's kind of a way to kind of narrow it down where we should pay our attention. The first one is we have to ask ourselves, where can projects improve habitat or reduce the risks? If we can't do that, we shouldn't be doing a project. The next one is, where are projects allowed? On a lot of our land, there's forests that we cannot manage. There may be a condition when the land was handed over that we can't cut any trees or do anything. McNeil Island is one of those places. We can't manage the forest on McNeil Island. Or when we got the land, the previous owner retained timber rights. So you've had those cases. And then you just simply have the case of, where is the management technically feasible? If it is inaccessible, we just might as well take it off the table as areas that we're going to actively manage. And I've got a little note at the bottom here. And when it comes to kind of defining the suitable areas for management, economic and social factors are not included in this. That's not to say they're not important, because a project is not going to succeed if the economics and the social support aren't there. But the reason why it's not included is those things are constantly changing over time. So there may be an area that needs forest management, and let's say It's not economically viable right now because timber prices are low and there's no mill nearby. So if you write it off and forget about it, what happens 3 years from now when the timber prices double and somebody builds a mill next door? You'd have to go find it and put it back on. So what we do is we identify the areas need management, whether it's feasible or not. The idea is to identify the needs. And so here's kind of the rough estimate of the needs right now. Of the 208,000 acres of forest that we have, about 100,000 of them could benefit from some form of active management. So that's about half. And almost all of that is in the dry forest of eastern Washington. We have about 60 to 80,000 acres of forest in eastern Washington that could immediately benefit from some type of thinning. Once they're thinned, they could use a maintenance level thinning or prescribed fire on about 3,000 to 6,000 acres every year. And when you consider most of those forests burned every 15 years, you take 100 divided by 15 and that's about 6. So that's why it needs, you know, kind of that level of thinning or some type of, you know, intervention in the lack or in the presence of widespread fire suppression. And that widespread fire suppression is not going away anytime soon. You know, it's an important thing. Now, some much smaller level of activity is we have about 6,000 acres of oak woodlands, prairie edges, and aspen woodlands that require some type of periodic treatment to counter the effects of fire seclusion, or they'll all eventually turn in, not all, but mostly will convert into a conifer forest, and we would lose several forest types. They would just gradually disappear from our lands. And then we have about 2,000 to 4,000 acres of plantations that could benefit from a one-time entry, but that's not really urgent. They're not like apt to the burn down or anything like that, and they will eventually reach a climatic climax stage. So one of the things is using this criteria, we can create kind of a master list of all of our forest management needs, and then we can just work off of that list. So the idea is we'd work off dealing with ecological and risk management priorities, and then, you know, factor in the public support, factor in the economic viability. And some of these projects can be self-funding, but there are a lot of areas where it's only going to happen if they're somehow subsidized because the trees just aren't worth enough. And then the staffing resources. And the idea is we'd have this master list and we could rank them from the most urgent to the least urgent, but we're never going to be able to just start at the top and work to the bottom. But what we can do is track where the work's getting done and where the work's not getting done. And, you know, we may find that we're all doing a lot of the work at the bottom of the list and not at the top of the list. So that's kind of a wake-up call. Or maybe we are working at the top of the list, but at least we know where we're at. So according to the kind of the criteria I had set up, is here's the typical high-priority areas. It's going to mostly be in eastern Washington, mostly in dry forest, and it's going to be areas where we can yield big improvements to ecological integrity, helping priority species, or reducing the risk related to severe wildfires, especially in the urban interface, and also the risk associated with insects. So we'd apply this logic to all projects everywhere, looking at ecological integrity, priority species, and risk reduction. Those are kind of the three main factors. And when you lay those out, most of what bubbles up to the top is eastern Washington forests. So, and here's just a look at the Kalakum, where we've got about 3,000 acres of this. And it's a shame because once you lose all those big trees amongst the small ones, it's a long time before you get back to where you were. So like moving forward, kind of what Clay said, kind of the next step would be we'd have to go through SEPA and then the get director approval of the plan. And then moving forward, Clay showed how we've got the development of new wildlife area management plans. When those are done, we would actually develop detailed inventories of the wildlife areas, forests, and they would come up with specific plans for how to restore their wildlife area forests with input from their local groups, and those would all be rolled up into a master needs list, and then we would just work off of that list trying to chip away at the backlog of all the problems and come up with a strategy or approach to kind of maintain our forests. And of course that's going to would involve partnering with adjacent landowners as much as we can. We've had very good luck working with the Forest Service at Sherman Creek and Oak Creek wildlife areas, sometimes even letting prescribed fires burn right across property lines. And also doing joint projects. The Forest Service is actually cutting some of the trees for us on the Met Howe. That is it. Thank you.
Well, excellent presentation. So full of information. Terrific. Any questions? I'm just really impressed. I think, shall we channel Chuck Perry for a moment? I think Chuck would be very impressed, too. He's our gold standard for thinking about habitat management as an important part of our mission. He was always asking the question, what can we do to enhance habitat for wildlife, not just the managing of people who take wildlife. He was always looking for those options for coming up with a better approach to habitat management. And I think the thinking that you're doing is exactly what he would be applauding if he were here. Just logical, thoughtful, deliberate, prioritized, given that we don't have all the money in the world to work with. I guess what struck me is when you talked early on about how much treatment we've been doing in the past, how much treatment we do in recent times, it's minuscule compared to what you've just laid out we need to do or we ought to do. You're proposing thousands of acres, not 190 or whatever it was. And that costs a lot of money. So, but it's until you make the argument that that's important, people don't connect the dots, that the cost of wildfires, the cost of bug damage, millions and millions of dollars of wasted timber resources, wasted habitat, that you just can't grow back in an instant. So I'm extremely impressed, really terrific. Director Anderson,
Commissioner Schmidt. Thank you, Chair. It's good to know that someone is looking out for our forest and are planning ahead. Mm-hmm. I've often wondered about it, given that we're up to, 600,000 acres? But I did have a question I've always wondered. When the department logs forest lands, often for salvage, either fire or insect, and the most recent example is the Clackam. What was estimated 20 million board feet is now over 30 million board feet. Where do the funds go once that harvest occurs? Does it go back into supporting the restoration of the land, or does it go into the general fund?
Do you want to answer?
Yeah, I believe that it doesn't go back into that particular wildlife area, but it goes back into the fund to be used to manage wildlife areas across the state. So it goes back in to manage the land, definitely.
Director Anderson.
Thanks. I had a chance to get together with Richard and Clay and go over this a couple weeks ago, I think it was. Maybe it was longer than that. And it's really, really exciting At the same time, it's a huge undertaking, and we're really fortunate to have Richard on our team, and we're even more fortunate that he's young because it's going to take him a long time to get this all done.
We're going to hold you responsible.
But and if you're, I think. Madam Chair, you talked about, you know, I think we're up to just under 1,000 acres a year that we're treating. We're talking about 60 to 80,000 that need some, are candidates for some immediate attention. And so looking for opportunity, I mean, I'm hoping, and maybe this is just wishful thinking, but I'm hoping there's some opportunities, there's some value to be derived from the activities, and it can help support the activities so that we can begin moving forward and we're not just going out and asking for funds from some funds yet to be identified fund source to get going with this. And I'm I admit to being a little bit impatient about I want to get started and start building that number of treated acres up as soon as we can. We've got a little bit of a process, and it's a good process to go through, prioritizing those 60 to 80,000. Where are we going to start? And I think that's going to be a balance of a number of different considerations as to where we start. You think about 900 plus thousand acres that we have, 200,000 of them, I believe it is forested. We've got 60 to 80,000 that need some immediate attention. There are some demonstrated real values on the looking at the long term from going in and addressing the problems with those forests. And I think we have the opportunity to, I don't know if it'll fund itself, but there's an opportunity to get some value out of those wood products as we go forward to help fund the process. So it's really some great work that they've done. I'm anxious to get started and pleased that they have an opportunity to brief you on what we're doing.
Okay. Any other comments? Just really terrific.
Thank you.